first impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
Home of LouisvillePolitics.com and EdSpringston.com. And I tell you, we've got a heck of a show for you tonight. Call-in numbers, as always, 858-683-1326 or 502-805-0334. For you listeners that are in the listening queue, we appreciate you as always. Make sure you hit the number one on your dial pad, and we'll try to get you on air as soon as possible. Chat room is open, so feel free to jump into the chat room. Using your Facebook and Twitter social media accounts, you can be heard in there as well. While you're at LouisvillePolitics.com, I ask that you do a couple of things. Please join our email newsletter. We will send an email direct to your inbox on a weekly or a monthly basis. We won't spam you every day like everybody else does. Pick and choose monthly or weekly basis, and we'll get all the latest news to you. And please join our RSS feed, where you can get the show delivered to your inbox as well. And while you're there, if you are so inclined, we are in the middle of a fundraising drive right now. We have to have some money to upgrade equipment and do different things, investigative reports, things like that. It all takes money, and we depend on you to do that. So if you don't mind, go to our GoFundMe link. It's at edspringson.com. Go to our GoFundMe page or use the donate button at LouisvillePolitics.com and help us out. I tell you, there were a lot of surprises last night during the election results, or were they? That's a lot of discussion we're going to go through tonight. Our good friend Ken Mulman will be joining us momentarily. He's running just a few minutes late as part of this post-election analysis show. But right now we have on the phone one of our regular guests and person that we think highly of at the show, Mr. Paul Holliger with Stop Invisible Taxes. How are you, sir?
Good evening, Ed. Hey, listen, I've got a little surprise for you. Also on the call, we have the number one analyst of the South End politics, the guy who's been involved in South End politics for more than 30 years, the guy that both the Democrats and the Republicans both fear and respect, Mr. Paul Hossie.
Paul Hossie. Yeah, I was going to say it has to be Paul Hossie. Paul Hossie is probably the most well-informed analyst you could possibly imagine when it comes to South End politics. He really is. He's an instrumental force throughout Louisville politics, and he should be feared by both parties because the guy is smarter than any leader they've got. How are you? How are you, Paul? You doing all right?
I am fine. Thank you for that build-up there. I appreciate it.
Well, I lie.
I'll buy your beer.
I lie a lot. Just ask Judge-elect Denise Brown. You know,
for those
of you who don't know the story on that, Judge-elect Denise Brown, she won last night and beat Dennis Burke. Apparently, she decided as part of her tirade, winner's tirade, if you will, the day after she actually won a judgeship, she decided to go out and try to tell the whole world publicly on a Facebook page that I was lying when I accused her last week of illegal campaign activity. So she decided to try to slander me, and apparently she's been making phone calls all day, because I'm getting a ton of them, doing the same thing. The only problem is I released one video that actually showed her doing exactly what I said she was doing, which was illegal, and for some reason she just doesn't understand. You don't go out there and accuse somebody of lying when you've been caught red-handed. So I'm sure there's going to be a slander suit going forward. I've already spoken to my attorneys today, and we're going to have a lot of fun with her. You don't go out there and do that kind of stuff, Judge. So hopefully your time on the bench will be extremely short. I'm going to do everything I can to make sure of it, because you are basically nuts. But anyway, with all that aside, you guys are on here, so let's just get right to it, because I tell you, it's very interesting to me when we look at what happened last night. You know, all day long, I've been listening, getting phone calls, listening to other people, and I was actually a guest on Michonne Daniels' show, The Focus Show, this morning, and we're looking at this election results. I don't think anybody was greatly surprised by the Senate elections. I really, really don't. But I was extremely pleased to see there's almost like an uproar across the entire nation, because not only did the Senate get the majority, which we expected, we've still got three out there, Alaska, Louisiana, and I believe it's Virginia, where they haven't declared one way or the other. But the Senate majority is still going to be there. You've got 52 Republican senators, 45 Democrats, two independents, and three seats still undetermined. But the House actually picked up seats as well, and we're still waiting on some results in states there. And what we saw was a Democratic campaign that was built, at least in my opinion, around three things. You're racist, Republicans are sexist, and Obamacare is perfect. And all three of those things, I think, got slapped right back into the Democrats' face when you look at people like Mia Love, a 30-year-old African-American female elected to Congress. When you look at that, you really throw the racism and the other sexist kind of stuff out. You know, we continue to look
at all
the...
Well, Ed, you're missing a really important point about Mia Love. What state was she elected from?
Was it Colorado?
So Colorado is not known for having a high African-American population. So that means a whole bunch of white folk put this Mia Love lady in charge of things. Wow. Imagine that.
It's not just that. If we look at the House seats, there's picked up 13 seats, the Republicans did. And I said, and I kind of gagged a minute ago. I actually had a hot coffee go down my throat wrong, so I apologize to our listeners. Still not feeling too good. But when you look at the winners in the House, you look at the Senate, you know, then you've got to go even further. Even the governors across this nation, you know, Republican governors have had the majority for quite some time if you go state to state, but they even picked up seats. You've got less than 10 governors in the nation now that are, you know, Democrats. And quite honestly, who was more surprised? I mean, really, truthfully, Paul Hossie, I really want to ask you this. Were you surprised when you saw Maine go red for a governor's race?
Yeah, I am. That is typically not what you would expect. There were several states that, you know, I mean, you may mention Mia Love. You know, there was also, and I can't remember the candidate's name, but there was also a black candidate elected to the U.S. House from one of the southern states, which I understand that to be almost a first. So the attempts to label the GOP by the Democrats, I think totally backfired. I mean, it turned out to be totally the opposite of what they were expecting. And I think you're seeing a shift. And I'll ask you this, Ed. You may know better than I. Is this shift, and I saw this first off as not so much as an election to support or to back GOP ideals, as much as this was an election where people came out and were voting against the Democrats. Now, in those states where the Republicans picked up, Are we seeing a shift more toward traditional GOP values, or are we seeing more of a shift toward the, I don't want to say Tea Party, but more the libertarian values, libertarian Republican values? What do you think about that, Ed?
Well, I tell you honestly, and I need to make a correction here. Mia Love is actually Utah. That's where I was getting tongue-tied when I swallowed my coffee wrong. Mia Love is actually Utah, and you're talking about going down south. You know, the
Mia
South is just elected.
Mia Love from Utah? Utah is unbelievably white.
Yeah,
and they elected
it.
A black woman and Mormon. Mia Love exemplifies Dr. King's vision. Judge a person on the basis of the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. Amazing.
Amen. And 30 years old to boot, she is the future of the Republican Party. And, you know, and what makes it even more fascinating is, I mean, when you look at this in Utah, you know, I mean, Utah is known for being very conservative. You got the Mormon agendas and all that stuff, too. But, you know, you now have the first, and this is very important, for somebody, we had the first black president. I mean, take Bill Clinton out of the picture, like Dale Gillespie likes to call him the first black president, but in Barack Obama. So is race really a factor? You've just elected the very first African-American female to the U.S. Congress in Mia Love.
Yeah.
You go down south, we just elected the very first African-American in Congress from the south. I'm having a hell of a time.
His name, Ed, is Tim Scott from South Carolina.
Right. It's Tim Scott, yeah. And, you know, I'm having a hell of a time trying to understand how in the world these buffoons, and I really hate to, and I know people hate it when I use names, but how this Democratic Party actually thought that they were still going to be able to try to use these kind of issues to divide the nation and get away with it, you know. And I think at the end of the day, you know, I think that what we've proven here is that this whole racist, sexist argument really is non-existent. It should have been proven when Barack Obama got elected in 2008 and was not. I think now we can prove that beyond a shadow of a doubt. But the underlying issue here, and this is where the problem is, this is kind of where I want to go tonight. I want to talk about what they did right and wrong in the Democratic Party, primarily Alice in Wonderland Grimes. We're going to get into a lot of that in a minute. We're going to look at some of the things that you know, really stand out from this election. You know, we're going to look at the piss-poor campaigns that were run. But, you know, there were some very, very real things. And I'm going to use the IJ Review here as a source because I think they did an incredible job. The IJReview.com, folks, and I'm going to go ahead and put that link into the chat room because I thought that they did a very good job in pointing out some obvious things in this election. There was at least 9 things that they felt were historic that happened in this election. And hello, Ken Moman. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm good. Sorry.
All right. We'll jump right in anytime. We've got Paul Hossie and Paul Holliger as part of this panel as well tonight. But when you look at these elections, you know, we wanted to talk about the South, as you mentioned a minute ago. South Carolina's Tim Scott became the very first black Southern Republican elected since Reconstruction. That is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
We look at Mia Love. Excuse me, I had to catch my breath. We look at Mia Love, phenomenal, very first female black Republican. And if you want to go even further, let's look at Arkansas. You know, let's go down to Arkansas. Tom Cotton, he is the very first Iraq War veteran elected to the Senate. You know, we'll get into a few more of these here in just a few minutes. But you know, I think that right now, truthfully, Paul Holliger, you mentioned a minute ago Dr. King's dream. You know, I and Paul Hossie, I think you would agree as well as I do. And Ken, I'll get your words on this as well. But I think you're seeing the culmination of Dr. King's dream in the last few elections. And I think this election proves that, you know, it is that these stunts that have been done by the liberal left have been divisive tactics intentionally to entrench their power, knowing that the American people just don't fall for that. Ken Moman, some comments.
Well, I think you're right, Ed. I think let me rewind and just kind of reiterate my point of view on this is that I think we're in a really good point in history where, you know, race is no longer really becoming a real factor. I mean, and I think it's a great thing because at the end of the day, I really don't care what race someone is. I believe there's one race, the human race. Skin color doesn't really mean squat to me. I think that that's going to become more and more prevalent. I think my generation, and especially the generation behind me, I think we're going to see a lot more of that. They just don't care, and that's a good thing.
Well, I think so, too. And I tell you, there's one other thing that really think needs to be bearing fruit, too, because I honestly believe that we have just proven that the racial divide and everything else is just a Democratic plot. The sexist divide is nothing else but a Democratic plot. But in this election, and I was speaking earlier today with you, Mr. Holliger, if I'm not mistaken, we had talked this morning. One of the things we talked about, what really was the root cause of the Republicans taking over, and why did so many Democrats either not go out and support their candidates or stepped away from their candidate and cross lines? And I tell you, the two prevailing factors in America today are the economy and national security. And I think, and we all talked about that a little bit this morning, and Paul, I want you to expand on that, because I believe that's true, that the people were voting against the Barack Obama referendum because the economy is tanked. Everybody is scared to even walk on their own streets, much less the borders. We're not considered number one superpower anymore. People look at the United States of America and laugh. We are perceived as weak. And I think that all of that combined, when you throw in illegal immigration and everything else we'll get to in a few minutes, I think that those two issues overrode any party political ties. Paul Holliger.
The societal issues that the two parties want to raise, if they don't deal with how an individual citizen feels in their particular lives, in their particular home, in their particular community, if they don't address those issues, all that other stuff doesn't mean anything. If people are having trouble paying their bills, if they're having trouble feeling safe in their homes, if they're having trouble feeling safe in their own country because of the politicians that are screwing things up deliberately, I might suggest, then all these other issues don't mean anything. These are what I refer to as bread and butter issues, okay? Bread and butter issues almost always crop up in every election, okay? The question is, which ones? And when you start trying to throw this war on women crap at people, when they're having insecurity galore, and by the way, some national polling has suggested that women in this country do not feel very secure right now. They are concerned about the safety and well-being of them, not just themselves, but their families. But when you fail to address, as a political leader, the basic issues of life and of having a good life in this country, you're going to lose. And the Democrats got shellacked because they tried to divert attention away from their colossal failure to meet the basic needs of the citizens of this country.
Paul Hossie.
I agree. I very much agree with what Mr. Hollinger said. I mean, at the end of the day, people are interested in the potatoes issues. They're interested in jobs. They're interested in health care. They're interested in safety for themselves and for their children. And on all three of those issues, the Democrats have shown that they cannot deliver. Despite all the rhetoric, despite all the race baiting, despite all the hypes and everything else, at the end of the day, they cannot deliver.
Ken Mullman, do you think that this was a referendum for the Republicans, or was it a referendum against the Democrats?
I think it's against the Democrats. I think the Democrats suffered two main problems here. Number one, they felt, people were still angry enough with the Republicans for putting us into this disaster that we have in we call an economy now, that I think they thought they were going to be okay that, we haven't really fixed it, but we didn't do it. They did it. We didn't do anything about it, but, it's their fault. And that only lasts for so long, man. I mean, you can only go a few years before you can stop, the finger has to start pointing back at somebody else, because those guys haven't been in power in like 6 years, and really eight if you count the 06 wipeout, which is when they all got pushed out. So it's been 8 years since the Republicans had the House and the Senate. And, it is a reflection on the Democrat policies. I think another thing this is a reflection of it, and I've heard some rumors that some of the campaign stuff that was going on in different parts of the country were kind of test marketing messages for the 2016 presidential race. The whole war on women thing is, in my opinion, a pretty obvious test marketing for a Hillary presidential run. We've learned in this race is that that message, that's not going anywhere. I think it was Monday night, Ed, we talked about the issues that were important to Kentuckians and Americans, and 22% was number one was the economy at 22%, and way down at the bottom, just barely beaten out, not sure, is war on 20%. So they never focused on issues that matter. I agree with the other two guys, and that's the issue. They didn't talk about things that matter. They didn't talk about the things that help you at home. Mm-hmm. They didn't talk about any of that. It was just, well, that guy's bad, especially here in Kentucky, right? It's like, well, McConnell's the bad guy, and not McConnell's to vote for. Ooh, that's inspiring. I'm inspired.
Well, what's really fascinating, and I say it's fascinating, too, when you look at that dynamic, Ken, since you brought that up. And I'm going to get into Hillary in just a minute, too, because I think there's a lot of obvious things were found out this election cycle about Hillary for 2016. But, you know, when you look at that dynamic, that Americans just don't trust the government, or they just don't trust the Democrats. The Democrats try to focus. Let's use the McConnell-Grimes race as an example of typical Republican races and Democrat races across the country in this cycle. And guys, how many times? But, you know, one of the major things that happened in this cycle was Allison Lundigan Grimes was going out there doing the same old talking points that the Democrats want. There's a war on women. I'm a strong woman. You know, we're not going to be treated badly. And the first thing she does is bring what I consider to be one of the most sexist, offending pigs in America today, former President Bill Clinton. If you don't like the language, I'm sorry for the liberals that listen to this show, but this guy is nothing but a sexual predator, in my opinion. And his wife Hillary aided and abetted destroying Monica Lewinsky. And these two are the best that they have to say that we stand up for women and how strong women are. And, you know, when you get into that dynamic, that really pretty much was played across the country. There's a war on women, and we talk about wage disparity, and we have already proven the wage disparity is a lie. Even the Democrats will admit now that this whole wage disparity and unequal income is a flat-out lie they were hoping to use. And when we look at Alice in Wonderland Grimes, we have to look at, you know, really truthfully, what are some of the things that she did wrong, and how was this portrayed across the rest of the country with Democrats? Well, the first thing I think we have to look at is the power of Barack Obama in this election. And essentially, there was no power from Barack Obama. Nobody would invite Barack Obama to campaign with them. And they opted for the number two choice of Hillary and Bill Clinton. And when you look at Hillary Clinton and all the races that she was involved in, I mean, she was a paid campaign is what she was. She didn't do this out of goodness of her heart. She was paid for this. But when you look at this, Hillary Clinton is supposed to be this model female presidential contender in 2016 that could bring all of this political clout to all of these candidates, and those candidates lost handily. Those candidates lost handily. Obama is not the only poison to the Democratic Party. I think in this election we also found out that Hillary doesn't have the support that she's living in this dreamland believing she has. Would you guys agree with that, any of you?
Ed, I think it would be a whole lot more efficient use of your time if you simply focused on what Alice in Wonderland Grimes did right.
You know, I've got to make this show stretch for the time that I have it for, Paul. but Mr. Hossie, I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, is that true? Was this not only a referendum against Obama and his policies? And for the record, I want to make sure I make this clear, too, because a lot of the talk shows today, you were hearing all these whiny-ass titty babies, and that's what I always refer to people who scream when they lose, take it and suck it up. But they're sitting out there saying, well, the only reason they lost is because everybody was making this election about President Obama. But the reality is President Obama made this election about President Obama. He did two things in recent weeks that destroyed the Democratic Party candidates. The first one was he told the whole world that this election was all about his policies and that his policies were on the ballot even though he wasn't. And then he told the whole world that all of these Democrats who weren't asking him to come campaign for him and running the other way, he made a statement that he understood why they were running away from him, even though these same candidates were voting for his policies up on the Hill. So he threw every Democratic candidate under the bus and made this election all about him. What else can we say about this? Go ahead, Paul Hossie.
I think you're right on that, Ed. Obama at the outset of this had indicated that this was going to be a referendum on his policies. and his administration. And I agree with Ken also in that this was not basically people running to embrace the GOP. This was a race about, this was an election about people running away from the Democrats. And the idea that you could, you know, that's one of the reasons. So, I mean, Obama is poison. He is absolutely poison. He is going to probably end up being one of the most hated presidents in U.S. history. And I think although your reputations tend to improve over time, I don't think his reputation is going to improve like some of the other presidents in the past. And I think the idea with Hillary, though, is that because Hillary is going to run despite all the games she wants to play, she is definitely going to be running. And I think they were setting the stage, and I think they were testing the waters to see how well she played in various states. And I think what the Democrats have learned here is that Hillary doesn't play as well outside of the Beltway in so-called flyover land. It's what they really think that she did. And I think that is going to be a lesson that the Hillary camp and the Democratic Party are going to have to look. She doesn't play so well in the heartlands of America. And real fast here, there was another black Republican that ran and won, and that name is Will Hurt from Texas, deep in the South.
Yep, yep.
And another lady that ran that we probably should address here if you have time is Sarah Blair from West Virginia. She's Republican, but here's the key issue. She was 18 years old, and
right.
She won. And the reason that's a key issue is because she is a millennialist. You know, she's that huge demographic that's coming up behind us baby boomers. And here's one that has run and won.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. And we're going to try to get into that as well. Ken Moman.
Yeah, hey, you know, I think I couldn't agree more. I think this was a huge test campaign for Hillary. I think they found out that Hillary is not nearly as popular as Bill was, that it really, honestly, between the two, even if their policies are the same, you know, Bill Clinton is a lot more suave. Bill Clinton has
mm-hmm.
that, you know,
mm-hmm.
hey, baby, it'll be all right. Just follow me. It'll be okay. And Hillary doesn't come off that
yeah.
way at all, right? And they can say the exact same thing, and I bet you, and I mean, this is just politics. I bet you if Bill Clinton says something and 60% of the people like it, Hillary says the same thing and 60% will hate it. And
you know,
that's just what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what they may be
probably,
you're right. You're absolutely right.
Well, there's probably one. There's only probably one true statement Bill Clinton could make at this point. That would be regarding Alice in Wonderland Grimes. You know, if he makes a statement that I did not have sex with that woman, it might be true. But, you know, all kidding aside, though, we look at this election, and I think we're seeing a big referendum against the liberal left agenda. Now, the interesting part of all of this is what's going to happen going forward, because the Republicans now have what they wanted. And one of the things I continue to have a conversation about with some people is, do the Republicans really want to lead? And that's not tongue-in-cheek question, folks. The Republicans mm-hmm. have been very good at passing the buck and blaming everybody else, and the Democrats have been doing that for quite some time. Well, now the Republicans can't blame anybody if anything goes on. They control the Congress, the House, and the Senate. So when we look at this in play, are they going to actually do what they were elected to do? And I tell you, there's some questions here, because I very rarely use this guy as a source, but I want to include this particular guy, some of his words in this dialogue. Rush Limbaugh, he was talking on his show today, and this was sent to me as a link. I don't never necessarily ever listen to Rush. This was sent to me today, and he says that the Republican Party was not elected to compromise. The Republican Party was not elected to sit down and work with the Democrats. The Republican Party was not elected to slow down the speed the country is headed to the cliff. He says that the Republican Party was elected to stop before we get to the cliff. And you look at that, and Rush also brought up some issues. He said the Republican Party has been given a mandate to stop Obamacare, stop amnesty, stop the open borders, stop big government, and stop these national security policies that have allowed these terrorist networks to pop up everywhere. And when we look at this, you know, again, I think it comes down to one of the basic premises. Were the Republicans elected to do all of these things, as Rush Limbaugh's trying to say they were, or were they just elected as an anti-vote to the Democrats? Because if they were elected to do all of these things, this country will move forward tomorrow. To hell with it. You know, Harry Reid is the biggest obstructionist in the Senate, and it's been proven. His own members, time and time again, complain because Harry Reid won't even bring up Democratic bills in the Senate unless it's something he wants. So, you know, we've been blaming Mitch McConnell for this. Well, now Mitch McConnell is going to be the majority leader of the Senate. And I know it's an elected position. I know Ted Cruz said he wasn't going to vote for him. But at the end of the day, reality is he's going to be the majority leader. Can Mitch McConnell deliver, or will it be the same old business as usual over the next 18 months heading into the presidential election in 2016? Ken Moman.
I'll tell you, you know, we have a not too distant history to compare this to. I think you're exactly right. The Republicans are very good at being an opposition party, whereas the Democrats a few years ago labeled them the party of no. They're pretty good at holding the line, generally. I mean, for a party, they're pretty good at saying no. But you look at what they did from 2001 to 2007 when they had the House and the Senate and the presidency. They ran through some really ugly things, some really bad things, things that we're still dealing with today, things that are still relevant today, things like the Patriot Act that people are still upset about, which enables all the NSA spying and all that. So it's going to be very interesting to see if the Republicans have learned their lesson from 2001 to 2007. I'd be apt to say that they have not. I think they're going to overplay their mandate here. I do think that's going to happen. I actually think this is going to be interesting to see what happens, because if they overplay their mandate, they lose in 16. And so I think it'll be very interesting to see.
Paul Hollinger.
I like the way Ken phrased the fact that the Republicans were handed a mandate yesterday, because I kind of look at that as the same way, but much like what was handed to them in 1994. And like Ken, I'm also concerned about whether or not they handle it correctly. Because in 1994, with Bill Clinton as president, they got control of both houses of Congress. And by 1996, some of those Tea Party folks, or the Contract with America crowd, actually began becoming part of the problem. They ended up getting co-opted by the Beltway thinking, and many of them got booted out in 1996, just two short years later. Okay, so my bigger concern is whether the voters yesterday, they didn't vote, and I'll reiterate this, they didn't vote for Republicans. They actually voted for the other guy. I heard that today. They voted for the other guy who's not a Democrat. And the other guy now has the responsibility for dealing with these issues that the American voters are upset with. Now, that speaks volumes, the fact that they voted for the other guy, because that means the Republican brand is still in trouble. The Republican brand has problems because they didn't vote for Republicans. They voted for the other guy.
I totally agree with you, Paul Hossie.
I agree totally with both fellows there. I don't think there was a Republican mandate. I think they were voting against the Democrats, and they were voting for basically anybody else. But now that they do have the majority in the House, I think that you're going to see the Republicans going to start infighting. They're going to start eating their own, much like you saw back in 1994 and later, where they were starting to have their own infighting. And I also think that, like you had suggested there, Ed, I think there is a strong probability that the Republicans really don't like to be in charge. I think they like to be in the position that they were, where they could always complain and blame it on somebody else. And when they've had to step up to the line, the GOP really haven't produced. You know, of course, now you've had presidents like Reagan and all that who've done well, but, you know, the House, you know, House and Senate, when they've had
let's
the
be clear here, though.
The GOP is just not produced. They're just not produced.
Well, let's be clear here, too, though. I mean, the Democrats haven't produced either, and I think this was a referendum on that point.
No, they have not.
When we talk about this whole kumbaya moment, you know, one of the biggest things that steps that really sticks out to me, let's take the economy aside for just a second, but let's focus on national security, for example, or Obamacare. But when you look at national security, America is perceived weak around the world today. You know, the Democrats were able to rise to power, elect Barack Obama, and take over the Senate and maintain the Senate largely on this anti-war and anti-boots-on-the-ground lies that they perpetuated. And I have to say lies because Barack Obama never fulfilled anything that he promised when he was elected as far as shutting all these daggone wars down, shutting, you know, Gitmo, all the other things that went along with that. And he is actually, for a guy who got the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, he sent troops into Afghanistan, Libya, all the other things we've done. So, you know, but now all of a sudden we have pulled back to act like we're this peace-loving nation. You know, do you think that the Americans are really dumb enough to believe, because historically the Republicans are known as a war machine, you can't hide that fact, it's just the way it is. Everybody knows that with the Republicans in control of Congress, then when it comes to boots on the ground and more war, that is probably something to be expected, and yet that didn't scare them. Do you think the American people want us to go to war, to shut these terrorist networks down, and to quit these little guys taking and giving them the opportunity to be big enough to harm us later? Do you think they're okay with that? Paul Hossie.
I don't think they're okay with it, Ed. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, Ken, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Go ahead, Ken.
I was going to say, I don't think the American people are happy about it, but I think what they've realized is it's going to happen either way. I mean, they voted for Obama. I agree with you that a large portion of the reason why Democrats swept into power in 2006 was people were just sick of war. And then following the 2008, mm-hmm. I mean, my God, Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize, like, I don't remember, it was like 3 days before or 3 days after he was inaugurated. I mean, he didn't even get to do anything before they gave him the Peace Prize. And I assume the Nobel Committee there has revised their practices as a result. But the point is that, hey, you know what? Here's what we've got. We've got two parties that are going to go to war, right? Let's be honest. The Republicans have a better track record of winning.
I think that's really what it came down to.
If we're going to go, let's win.
Well, let me ask another question then. Okay, and I agree with, I actually agree with that statement. You know, but let's ask another question. I'm not necessarily saying that America wants more war. Americans are sick of war in general. But do you think that they inevitably now believe what the Republicans were saying when Barack Obama took office, that we have to finish the job, we have to do this correctly, or it's going to be an ongoing thing forever? And from Barack Obama's, you know, 6 years in office to date, it's proven to be true that the Republicans were right. We pulled out of Iraq, and look at Iraq now. You've got the ISIS situation and everything else in the Middle East has went nuts. We've got beheading after beheading, and everybody's getting used to that. It's no longer a situation where, you know, we're disgusted or horrified. It's become an everyday way of life, and that's not the American way of life. Paul Hossie, go ahead.
Well, my opinion on that, Ed, and it's probably not going to be a very popular opinion, but my thoughts on it, and I've kind of spent some time doing some research and, of course, a lot of my articles on this subject, but I think we have reached the stage, regardless of Democrat, Republic, I don't think it makes any difference, where we are going to be faced with the perpetual war. It's not going to go away. We have the perfect enemy, terror, in quotes. And I don't think it vanishes. I don't think it matters if it's a Democrat in office or a Republican to control the House or vice versa. I think we are on a war footing. I think this is perpetual war. Right now it's keeping the economy going. And it takes care of a lot of excess unemployment. I think this is our future. And until the American people have decided enough's enough. I think a lot of these terrorist groups, a lot of people have realized, are creatures of our own creation. I think a lot of Americans realize that we're in reality not fighting as much for freedom as we are fighting for possession of of natural resources. I mean, that's what it's coming down to. That's what it's all about anymore, is who controls natural resources. And I think that's where we go with this. I think the American public is sick to death of war. We've never been a country that's been big on war. We've never backed down from a war. And the American public has always believed, if we're going to fight, then by God, let's kick their ass and get home. And that's not the mentality anymore. That's not Washington's mentality. Now it's the perpetual war. And it provides excuses for NSA, it provides excuses for Patriot Act, it provides all this other stuff that's going on in terms of national security. It even underpins the idea of this police state mentality that we seem to have in this country. I don't think it matters, Ed. I really don't. If it's a Democrat or Republican in there, I think this is our future.
Well, and you know what? I think you're probably right about that. And to me, you know, it's one great way to circumvent the Constitution and eliminate privacy in America and make us all part of the establishment. You know, but you mentioned the economy in that equation as well. Wars are expensive. But when we look at the realities, of war, a couple of things have to be pointed out here, and I think it's very important to do so. For one thing, you're right. Having this war, this ongoing war, this never-ending war, actually does aid our economy. But unfortunately, it aids our economy in a negative way because we're continuing to borrow money to finance this war. So, war is good for the economy when it comes to jobs, but it's good for the economy overall when we get to a point where we're borrowing so much money we can't ever pay any of it back. Well, we're actually there now. People really want to look at everything that's not on the books. But, we have to look at this economic situation, too, and let's talk about the economy for a second. Paul, I know you want to weigh in on this, but we look at how much these wars are costing us, and we look at the economy as a whole. Are the wars really such a drag on the economy, or is it the economic policies that we've been following that are such a drag on the economy? And I'll give some examples of that. And Paul Hogg, weigh in.
Well, both of the issues that you cite are drags on the economy. The problem with the war aspect is that the war takes capital out of the American marketplace that could be used for other things. And the amount of capital that it consumes is huge. It is huge. Contrary to what a lot of liberal-minded individuals think, there is not an unlimited supply of money. Okay, there is a limited supply of money. And the liberals like to think that there is a limited supply of money, because that's the basis for their entire wealth redistribution ideology. But having said that, what they don't realize is that when you take money completely out, when you don't redistribute it to the people, it goes to the corporatocracy, also known as the fascists. Paul Hasse did an excellent job of describing what we have here in the United States, and that is a version of American fascism. Forget the ideology. The only ideology that matters to the fascists here are dollars and cents. That's it. How do we get dollars and cents? Everything else is simply what I learned in business school is called a factor of production. That's it.
Let's look at that too, because the number one thing that America produces today, it seems like anymore, are stock dividends. I mean, we're really not a manufacturing country anymore. We're a service economy, and most of the wealth is maintained in non-manufacturing enterprises. And when we look at the economic collapse of the U.S. and everything else, and believe me, folks, it's coming. We're already there. We just don't want to admit it. But what has had more of an effect on the economy overall? And that's a question I want all of you guys to talk about, because Paul Hasse, of course, for you guys who don't know, he runs his own website, Another Opinion by Paul Hasse, Hosse. Look it up online. And Paul actually spends a lot of time, research, and efforts in world affairs and things like this. Paul Hollinger, for those of you who don't know, is an independent in the state of Kentucky, a well-known independent crackerjack researcher. This guy can find stuff I can't even find. And, of course, Ken Mulman is a Libertarian Party chairman of Kentucky. So we bring all these people together, just so our listeners know, so we can get other views from other things. We're not going to make this a conservative, Republican, or Democrat thing. I want all these different views. But with that in mind, really, truthfully, let's look at this economy, because we're not promoting jobs. When you look at this whole minimum wage fight that's going on right now with the liberal left, it's ironic to me that the unions are screaming we must have this minimum wage raise and, you know, we have to have this equal pay for women. Ironically, you don't find any women in a union shop who are not paid equal to their counterpart. There certainly is no income inequality. What the hell would they know about that? When we look at this fight for $15 an hour for McDonald's workers, for example, now McDonald's has taken the test kiosks that they've been using over in Europe for quite some time and brought them to the U.S., where you're going to walk into a McDonald's, make your order on a computer kiosk just like you do an ATM machine, pay for it right there, and then go to the end of the counter and get your food. It's going to eliminate so many workers, it's unbelievable, and it's not going to stop at McDonald's.
Oh, but the order will be right. The order will be right. Yay!
Hey, you know,
this is good.
Well, it's possible. That depends on if Die Boat is responsible for the machines or not. I mean, you can't get the voting right with those machines. But you know, I mean, how can you order, you know, no lettuce or something when you can't figure out a Republican or Democrat on a computer kiosk? But, you know, realistically though, the whole problem with the economy, you know, is the fact that the government has been so involved in the economy instead of letting the free market take its rightful place, as I like to believe. And I preface that and I point that out for this reason alone. The economy became in a shambles because of these bank bailouts. Eric Holder essentially went on record, our soon-to-be former attorney general, thank God. Eric Holder went on record and said that essentially the banks are too big to fail. We have no accountability in the financial markets whatsoever. These people, all of these people who have lost their homes through these illegal foreclosures and everything else, and I was a victim to that. I'm fortunate enough to still be in my home, but it took thousands of dollars that I won't get reimbursed for to beat these clowns at that game. You know, when we look at this, the government has taken a so-called billions of dollars, which is nothing more than a paper transaction, in these fines against these banks, but nobody's went to jail, and those billions of dollars didn't go back to the homeowners. You know, they were being screwed by the government. So we've made these banks so big to fail, we've allowed them to control all the money with no financial regulations or oversight whatsoever. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase. Isn't that more reflective of the problems with this economy than a few billion dollars that we're spending on war? Ken Molman.
I think you're exactly right. I think the too big to fail thing, you know, I'm not a big proponent, obviously, of regulation, being a libertarian, but I do have a really big problem with bailing out the losers. I mean, if you're gonna let people, it was a really good phrase about what was really wrong is that we are capitalizing gains and socializing loss, and you can't perpetuate a system like that. If you're gonna let people invest and take the risk, then they have to have a risk. The risk has to be there because the risk is a check and balance on bad behavior. This too big to fail mentality is actually what created the bad behavior in the first place. Oh, well, the banks are so big, we can get away with doing this because, hey, if we crash, they'll come bail us out, because if they don't, the whole economy will crash. No, what should happen is that those banks should have went, oh, well, sorry, you engaged in bad practices. Their assets should have been sold on the open market for 10 cents on the dollar or whatever the market would bear. The little banks who are now being wiped out by the regulations that came in the wake of all of that stuff, they should have been the ones who instead – they should have benefited by not engaging in those bad practices and been able to buy all those assets. The market would have regulated itself back out, and everything would have been happy hunky-dory. And instead, what we've done is we've rewarded bad behavior, and we've learned nothing. Nothing's been fixed, and we still haven't had this conversation about bailing out corporations. And I guarantee you in the next 10 years or so, we'll bail out another corporation, because it seems to be every 10 to 15 years we bail out some industry. Bailed out the airlines,
well,
bailed out the car companies multiple times, and now we got the banks.
Well, it all started with Chrysler and Lee Iacocca and the $10 billion bailout that he received many, many years ago. We started down that road of too big to fail. And, you know, you talk about winners and losers. Essentially, what they did is the government itself just decided who was going to be the losers, because they said the banks who should have been the losers are too big to fail. So we'll just take all of that money and we'll make the homeowners the losers who have invested their life savings into these homes and everything else to make sure the banks don't lose. So the rich got richer, the poor got poor. Paul Holliger, please go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Ken Molman.
Okay, I was
Ken's
just
on
say,
a roll.
I,
go,
you know,
Ken.
I want to say the other side of it is, you know, we got done with the banks. Then after we did the banks, well, that justified bailing out the auto companies again. And what happened there, right? We end up with GM getting saved, quote unquote, great. But, you know, I was a Saturn owner, right? Very loyal. Saturn has this, like, crazy loyal fan base. I wasn't quite that fanatic about it, but it's there, and I understand it. So, you know, Penske Racing Company, wanted to buy Saturn off of GM. GM didn't want to let anybody else into the market. They told them no. Now, if they had gone bankrupt like they should have, there would have been no choice. A court would have said, hey, Penske Racing, you're the highest bidder for Saturn Motor Company. It's yours. And Saturn would still be being produced today. The reality is we broke the market. Broken. And you can't – we have to do something very, very different. And the problem is that in this election, this cycle, we didn't talk about any of these issues. We were distracted by stupid things that don't matter. In 5 years, we won't talk about again.
Absolutely correct. Paul Holliger, go ahead.
I really don't have anything to add to what Ken said because Ken's view on this, it's right on target, Ed. It's right on target. And the that's one of the advantages of being kind of a guy affiliated with a political movement that is not part of the duopoly, okay? They bring a totally fresh perspective to things. So Ken's right on target.
Okay, Paul Hossie.
I agree with Ken. By way of disclosure, my academic background is in economics, and I think Ken's analysis is accurate. The way the economy should function, it is not functioning. You know, and the concept of a company being too big to fail, to me, I'm thinking, well, if it's too big to fail, then it needs to be nationalized. Otherwise, the market needs to run its course, and what happens.
Well, just to reinforce,
being the realist of it, you have to look at the fact that these corporations that were bailed out are the same corporations that finance and back most of these politicians that are running for office. And you've got the revolving door issue. A lot of these people go from those type of banks, AIG, into the government, and from the government back into the private sector case and everything else. So this was much more than just simple coming in and bailing out a bank because it was too big to fail. This was one hand washing the other, and as usual, the ordinary American got the shaft.
Well, welcome to the Citizens United era. You know, when we look at this, and I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, well, that's it. The corporations do own America now, because they've got the right to have speech, which is crazy to me, but that's the way it is. But, Ken, you brought up a point, too, when you were talking. You said that in 5 or 10 years we're going to have the same conversation because it continues repeating. And I think that we can really prove that even more so, prove your statement, because let's look at this reality. When you talk about the money that was spent in this election, let's go to Kentucky and Mitch McConnell and Alice in Wonderland Grimes. Mitch McConnell spent $20 million. $20 million of outside money right here in Kentucky, in addition to whatever else he spent out of his pocket, which was $22 million. But $20 million of outside money came into Kentucky through Mitch McConnell. And the liberals are screaming, it's the rich billionaires trying to buy your election, but they don't want to tell the whole world that Alice in Wonderland Grimes had $15 million spent in this election on her behalf, and that was just through mid-October. We don't know what the latest are since then because it hasn't been reporting. So, the Democrats spent, millions of dollars as well, 75% of the total that McConnell outside sources did. So, this is just a tit-for-tat argument, just lying and deceiving. And when we talk about nothing is going to change, I think the president, he decided he had to have a press conference today to the American people because he got his ass handed to him last night. But as part of his speech, he had this to say. He said that there is no doubt that Republicans had a good night. All right. And then he went on to say that to the voters who handed the GOP control of the Congress, he said, I hear you. It's time for us to take care of business. That, to me, was a disgusting statement by the President of the United States. Well, I hear you now because you just handed our ass to us. It's time for us to take care of business. So the obvious, thought process here is, for the last 6 years, you've been acting like two-year-olds and not taking care of business. Now he wants to talk about siting, construction of roads, bridges, infrastructure, and those type of things. He said expanded trade was something that they will now look at because he can't stop it. But his next statement really concerned me. I tell you why. This president has been accused of overreaching efforts of trying to legislate from the White House, if you will, through the use of executive orders and executive privilege. And, you know, as part of that, he went on to say, Congress will come with some bills that I will not, that I cannot sign, and I'm pretty sure I will take some actions that some in Congress will not like. So the short way to interpret that is, I've been doing my own thing since I've been here. I really don't care who's in charge of the Senate. I'm going to screw the Republicans just as much as I screwed the Democrats for the last 6 years in the Senate. So these are very important issues. One of the things that he mentioned was that if Congress doesn't take action by the end of the year on illegal immigrants, that he is going to order himself, order a reduction in deportations of illegal immigrants. All of these things are issues that are inflammatory, combative, and he just told the whole world he's going to do what he wants to do like he's always done. So when we talk about this kumbaya moment that we mentioned earlier in the show, we're not going to get there clearly, and this president still doesn't understand that it's going to take compromise to move the United States forward. Paul Holliger.
I disagree with you, Ed.
Okay.
This compromise mentality has gotten us into the dilemma that we're in now. There's been too damn much compromise. We need leadership on selected key issues. Somebody has got to find a backbone soon because we're headed toward a cliff. We're headed toward a cliff, and we need somebody to stand up and say, give me the key, I'm stopping the car. But we haven't found anybody like that yet, okay?
You may have misunderstood
the compromise thing. Ed, the compromise thing, again, I really take issue with your use of that concept. While it does happen, the question is, in desperate times, you don't compromise. You make bold decisions that are based with in a person's good sense. And we don't have anyone on the national scene with those qualities right now.
Well, here's what I'm trying to get at here. All right, we have a Congress that is Republican controlled. They have not been able to get any of their issues addressed. There has been, if you want to talk about compromise, the Senate has been uncompromising under the leadership of Harry Reid to the largest degree. The president has been unwilling to work with any Republican in Congress on both sides of the aisle. When I look at compromise, when I use that term compromise, you may take offense, but what I'm saying here is this. If the election was indeed a referendum against the policies of the liberal left and against Barack Obama himself, he has not seen the light and truthfully come to understand that the Congress makes the laws, that he has to work with the Congress. And he's still unwilling to do that with that remark. And that has been one of the biggest divisive issues that has forced us into the situation we're in. He has used executive privilege and executive orders.
So you have correctly assessed the shortcomings of President Feckless, okay? But that, again, doesn't address the underlying issues of getting the problem solved. President Feckless has been President Feckless since day one. Okay,
and what
so
we're
the question
see
is,
now,
why do we have Feckless Congress? Okay,
I agree.
Why do we have a Feckless Congress?
I'm not disputing that. The point I'm trying to make here is we're still making this a contentious, divisive thing that I don't think the president actually understood or really cares the mandate from the American people that was handed to him and his party last
night. He understands it completely. You are so wrong on that. Obama is he's a cold, calculating political hack. He understands completely what went on. He is trying to cover his feckless backside.
That much,
and he's lame duck anyway.
I probably worded that wrong. Go ahead, Ken.
Well, he's lame duck. He's lame duck anyway. What does it matter? I mean, here's the thing, right? A president, the power of the president. If you go back and you look at, I mean, go all the way back to the constitutional debate, the debate of the Constitution, where the presidency actually came from. The power of the president is to do or do not. Right? Congress passes a law, and it is up to the president to execute, executive branch to execute those laws. The check and balance he has is that he can choose not to execute those laws. And if Congress does not like that, then they have the power to – and in some ways, I have a feeling that that's almost what's going on here, is that Obama is back to daring the Republicans to impeach him. I think that's where we're at.
Let me ask you something, and Paul Hossie, I really want you to weigh on this as well, but let me ask you something. And folks, for the record, we are going to go into overdrive. We're going to take this show past 8 o'clock, so I just want to let everybody know. Occasionally we do that because I love the discussion when we can get it. Paul Hossie and Ken, you know, well, Ken, I want you to finish on this. You talked about, you know, this president, but hasn't this president, you know, essentially, you know, Paul Hollinger mentioned he's been a feckless president. The American people are sick of the executive orders and the executive privilege that he's doing. I mean, he even tried to put executive privilege on Eric Holder's wife, who is not a government employee and has no entitlement whatsoever to that. We talk about Congress has the ability to pass the laws. The president has to accept or reject them. And then the Congress has the ability to do two things. They can veto the law or they can impeach the president. They can override the veto. But here's the thing, Ken. You talk about impeaching the president. I want all of you guys to weigh in on this. Wouldn't that be the worst mistake the president or the Republicans could ever do at this point in time, is try to impeach this lame duck president 2 years before an election that they desperately won? Ken.
Yeah, I think the smarter thing is exactly what they're doing right now, which is to threaten to just defund anything that he tries to do. If he does it the way they don't like it, they'll just take the money away. And that's what they should have been doing all along. It's what they threatened to do originally with Obamacare, and then they, of course, didn't do it. But I think that that's the real power play that they have in the Congress, because if you start bringing charges up now, and I've said this before on the show, man, the Republicans don't want to go down in the history books as the group that tried to impeach the first black president. I mean, I'm just laying it out there. That's what they don't want in the history books. They're not going to go after him. He's lame duck 2 years. And let's be honest, the last year, that's going to be consumed by the presidential campaign. So we were talking about a year, year and a half at the most. I think it would be a huge mistake to try to impeach, as much as there are a lot of people who, you know, especially the red meat Republicans, as I call them, would love to see that happen.
I think you're absolutely right. Paul Hossie.
I agree with Ken, but for a different reason. First off, to impeach him would take the 2 years probably, or close to it, time they got around to it, to actually do the job. I mean, Clinton was able to stay it off for quite some time. But anyway, beside the point, the Republicans need Obama. They need the fact that he is so negative, so hated, and they need somebody that they can basically blame, point the finger at, and say, we tried, but he wouldn't let it happen. He overreached. He did this. He did that. They need him. They need Obama as that foil.
So they need the devil.
Before
they could point at Harry Reid and Barack Obama, they've just eliminated pointing at Harry Reid. Now they only have Obama left. Paul Hollinger, go ahead.
Hossie's point about Obama being a useful idiot, right on the mark. The issue of impeachment, it is a non-starter. Let's move on.
And that exactly is what I'm hoping is. I, you know, my fear is that, you know, Mitch McConnell has been quoted in over and over over the last few years. You know, his number one goal is to get rid of Obama, and that kind of thing. And that played very well in a lot of circles. It didn't help the elections at this time for the Democrats, but it did play well in a lot of circles. And you know, so I'm kind of curious to see what happens from this point forward. Now he has the power to actually try to do that. It's going to be an interesting contrast. You know, just to get back to a few things here, because I still want to get through a few things. You know, some of the things that are, you know, really interesting here. You know, as we know, the Republicans won a majority of the Senate. But they also picked up the Senate House, the governor's races they picked up, you know. But believe it or not, there was actually some surprising wins for the Democrats. You look at Jean Shaheen in New Hampshire. She was supposed to lose that big, and she had her seat. And Ted Kennedy Jr. actually moved to Connecticut rather than run in Massachusetts, where the Kennedys always run at. And Ted Kennedy Jr. was able to win in Connecticut as well. So, you know, and of course we had the polling violation. So there were a lot of things in this election to look. But what's really interesting here, too, and I want to put this out, it's fascinating because Ken, I think, mentioned it earlier, Elise Stefanik. This is the youngest woman elected to Congress, as was pointed out. She's 18 years old. What people don't understand is she actually won the GOP primary as a high school senior at 17 years old, folks. That's not a joke. It's the truth. A high school senior won the GOP primary. And now is I'm sorry, that was Stephanie. I apologize to Sarah Blair. But Sarah Blair in West Virginia. And it's really fascinating because Sarah Blair, as a high school senior, was able to pull this upset without the party machines or anything else. So for those people who think you don't make a difference in elections, I think this is a clear example that at least some people in this country get how important elections are. Would you agree with that?
No, I don't know. I think it's an anomaly, but it's a fun anomaly. You didn't mention her margin of victory over a 44-year-old white guy who is the incumbent. I think the margin was 61-39, so it was a decisive victory for this girl. And again, I think this is just another example of yesterday's vote for the other guy. For the other guy. She happened to be the other guy. Okay?
I get all of that. I just think it's very, very interesting that, you know, you've got this incumbent and Larry Kump back in the primary. And she was able to beat him in the primary. I mean, the general election, we've already established that, yeah, this was a vote against the other guy. But for a 17-year-old high school senior to win a primary against a political machine incumbent, that is very, very interesting to me. And she did it on less than $5,000. And then you throw that in with Mia Love, you know. Then you've got Elise Stefanik, 30 years old. You know, you've got all these different anomalies in this election. So are these really anomalies? Or is this the American people finally saying, hey, you know what? The establishment screwed up. Let's try something different. Are we finally waking up in America? It might be small gains, but are we finally waking up in America that the old guard and the old dog is not going to learn any new tricks and it's time to put that old dog to sleep? Paul Hossie.
I wish that was the case, Ed. I think this was a vote against the Democrats. This was not a vote for the Republicans. I think it is significant that Sarah Blair won because of her age demographic, because she's a millennial. I think that is important because the millennials are, as a group, strongly left-leaning, not necessarily Democrat, but they are strongly left-leaning. And I think this is significant. It goes to show that there are millennials out there that the GOP could potentially win over if they would actually make the effort. I think it goes to show that the GOP can win minorities, females, which they do horrible at, and minorities, which they're dismal. But it goes to show that if the GOP is willing to reach out, they have the potential to win. Are these anomalies, as Paul Hollinger said? I don't know. They are worth watching. If this repeats again, and perhaps the next election cycle or even the next two election cycles, then there is something happening here. Then there is a big change underway within the GOP. I personally don't think so. I think these are temporary flukes because they are voting against the Democrats, and I think These are protest votes. I think these protest votes. Of course, win's a win. You know, you take it any way you can get it. I see these more as protest votes right at the moment. Like I said, if it continues, if it happens in the next election cycle, or maybe even the next two election cycles, then there's a trend happening here. Then there's a trend maybe in the mentality of the GOP establishment. But I really don't see it. I wish I did. I really do. I wish I could see that change, but I don't, Ed.
Paul Hollinger.
No, I've got nothing to add to that. I mean, the Hossie's concern, and what your audience may not know, is Paul is a student of demographics and statistics. So his opinions are derived from his study of what is happening now versus what has happened historically. And in doing that, you make your best guess as to what might happen tomorrow. So the question as to whether or not this is the leading edge of a wave that is developing, that's a great question. That's a great question. And we're just going to have to hopefully stick around long enough to find out if, in fact, it is the beginning of a wave of change, or is this just a fluke?
Fair enough. Ken Mulman.
Yeah, and I have to agree with Paul Hasse that, you know, I would like to, that this would be a real change. I think what we're actually seeing, and based on political cycles, I actually think we're at the end of this cycle. I think the Tea Parties are going to fade away. I think all of this stuff, the establishment is getting control of the political process again. If you go back in time and you look, every 14 to 16 years, the establishment loses control of the political realm, and they lose it for about 2 to 4 years, and then they get it back. If you use 2010 as that moment, we're now in 2014. I think, yeah, there were some anomalies this time around. There are anomalies every time around. I mean, it is kind of funny. I've always said that politics is degenerating into nothing more than running for class president. And I guess, you know, that the woman in West Virginia proved that. But the point is that I think we're at the end of that cycle. I don't think we're at the beginning of it, unfortunately. As much as I'd like to see that cycle continue, and I think it'll be another decade before we see it kick back up again.
Well, here's my thing with that, and I'll make a quick comment. I really want to get into Allison and Mitch. I think that's a discussion we need to have in the minutes that are remaining. But, you know, when we look at this cycle, I agree with you. Don't have enough evidence yet that there's a cycle that's going on here. But I would take issue and probably disagree with the comments about the Tea Party, and I'll tell you why. Because what we have seen in the establishment since the advent of the Tea Party, Rand Paul is now the face and the voice of the Republican Party. He's a Tea Party libertarian. That's as simple as that. Tom Massey won his reelection bid very handily last night in Kentucky as a Tea Partier. If you look across the country, you take folks, Justin Amash, Ted Cruz, you know, these guys are all mentioned prominently in just about everything that happens to come from the old guard GOP establishment. These are becoming the faces of the Republican Party. So the old guard, typically, in my opinion anyway, the old guard may be trying to circle the wagons, but I think they have created a situation that's going to go out of control on them really quickly and not allow them to do that by allowing these Tea Party patriots, if you will, to come the face and the voice of the party itself. So it's going to be interesting to see if the Tea Party fades away, and I'm not sure it will. And we've got to give props to Phil Moffitt. Phil Moffitt is a Tea Partier. You know, Phil Moffitt, you know, has libertarian leanings, and Phil Moffitt got elected last night to the state Congress. So, you know, there's a lot of different things going on. One of the things I want to get into this Alice in Wonderland Grimes and Mitch McConnell race. Typically, we start with local and state election stuff here or issues here on this show, but I saved them for last because we're going to close the show with this stuff. We've got about 15 minutes left, and here's the thing: Alice in Wonderland Grimes showed less class than anything I can imagine in this so-called concession speech last night. Her concession speech was nothing but glorifying the old Democrat guard, Steve Beshear, Paul Patton, and everybody else she can name on stage for being on board, without ever mentioning Mitch McConnell or giving him props or anything else, which is really unheard of in election campaigns. And as we look at the mistakes Alice and Grimes made, I want to point out a few here, and I think that this is really interesting. We look at Grimes' missteps and everything she did. I think the number one thing she did late in the race was denying Barack Obama. She refused to say she voted for him, and that showed her as a very weak candidate. You know, she could not speak off the cuff. She stayed to a script that was provided to her, you know, by insider people. I mean, former campaign spokesman for Barack Obama, Ben LaBote, and the ex-White House press secretary Obama, Robert Gibbs, were the ones who were actually prepping her for the only debate that she had with Mitch McConnell. Those were the guys that were doing the prep work with her, Obama insiders. And, you know, so when you look at all of this stuff, we have to look at the money. Jerry Lundergan, as we know, you know, convicted but overturned because they charged him with felony instead of a misdemeanor, her dad, was essentially calling the shots. you look at all of these things in play, and let's look at the internal polling that Jonathan Hirsch kept lying to people about. I think it's clearly obvious that Alison in Wonderland Crimes was really screwed from the word go. She didn't have any shot. She was never in this race. And, you know, why was that? These are just some of the small missteps, and there's other things we can get into. But, Kim Mulman, why do you think she lost so easily?
Well, I think you've summarized it pretty well. Number one, she committed Democratic Judas in denying the Messiah three times. You know, I think, or no, that wasn't Judas. That was the other guy. Anyway.
What a great analogy. That's a great analogy.
You know, but anyway, the point is that, you know, she denied Obama. I think that was kind of the final nail in the coffin. I think there were missteps all through this campaign. I think the number one thing is they never hit a theme. I mean, like the first month it was one thing, and then the next month it was like the war on women, and then the next month it was this thing, and the next month it was this thing, and you know, pretty early on, McConnell went into, you know, Obama needs Grimes, Kentucky needs McConnell. And that was the bumper sticker slogan that he hammered in every commercial break for 4.5 months. And, you know, I think that worked. I think those are the two main things. I tell you, you know, in tying back this all together with what I said before, I think my biggest disappointment with this race are the number of Tea Party folks that knuckled under and went for Mitch, even though the whole reason the Tea Party started was because of the bailouts. And Mitch was the biggest cheerleader for the bailouts, but they all went, oh, cool, I guess we'll vote for Mitch. And then meanwhile, you have people on what would typically be considered the left side that really didn't like Grimes and didn't like a lot of what she was saying, but were too afraid to come out and switch as well. And I want to point out the fact that no matter how many votes happened here, there was a 16-point spread in this race. I mean, it was ridiculous. It wasn't even close. And these polls, the polls did show that it was about an 8-point race going into this, but boy, 16 points is an absolute blowout. And I'll tell you, if I'm in Grimes' camp, I'm thinking seriously about not running for re-election next year, sitting out for a decade and letting the wounds heal.
I kind of agree with that. Look at what happened to Jack Conway. He's had enough losses. Paul Hossie, quickly.
Real quickly, I think that she broke the cardinal rule in politics, which is to let your opponent define you. And that's exactly what happened. McConnell was able to define her, and she was unable to find her voice.
Holliger?
Now, she found her voice. It was in her handlers. They found her voice over in with her handlers, okay? And I think that I want to hammer home that point to add to your conservative listeners and to your liberal listeners, and that is, in Kentucky, it has been long assumed by the Democrats and long feared by the Republicans that the Democrats and their strategies can do no wrong because they have dominated Kentucky politics for such a long time. I think that this Grimes campaign disaster should put an end to that. The Democrat strategists are no more competent than the Republican strategists are, although I really should have said they're just as incompetent as the Republican strategists, okay? So don't fear the Democrat machine, as you like to call it, Ed. We shouldn't fear that. They make major mistakes, and the Grimes campaign is their blue ribbon award-winning major mistake.
And you know what? There's some other things that come to light here, and I agree with all of you guys so far. But Guy Cecil, he's the executive director of the DSCC. As we know, the DSCC, the Democratic Senator Campaign Committee, decided to pull out just a couple of weeks ago and not spend any more money on Alison Grimes' campaign. They felt that she was basically out of the race at that point, and as we know now, she was.
Mm-hmm.
But what did Grimes do? The first thing she did was make a phone call to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to complain. Next thing you know, the DSCC says, okay, we're going to spend some more money. So you look at the Obama ties, you look at the Harry Reid ties, you know, and things like that. It's very disturbing. One of the things that Grimes, her dad, did before she ever decided to announce she was running is went to Hollywood before she even decided to run and met with Jeffrey Katzenberg, to make sure that the Hollywood liberal elite was going to give her all kind of money, which they did. You know, it came to a thing that it was all about the money. It never was about the issues. You know, and the DSCC, Guy Cecil, had tried desperately, according to all reports, but had tried to give Grimes an office, you know, that would help her in her race. But unfortunately, they turned down. Grimes rejected every aide and staff that was done and reached directly out to Harry Reid to tell her how to handle this. So once again, we've got a referendum of how this insider game is run. It's very disturbing. It's very disturbing. You know, and if we want to look at the money here, I mean, you know, the biggest concern that Jerry Lundgren had, for his daughter was the money. So we go to Hollywood, we go to Barack Obama, we bring Barack Obama handlers in here to campaign for and to prepper. We bring Harry Reid guy in here to campaign for and to prepper. When you look at the money disparities, McConnell spent about $22 million of his money, not outside money. And that was almost $2 million of his own money that he actually put into this campaign. And Alice in Wonderland Grimes has spent over $15 million. So as we said, the money wasn't the issue. The issue was that there were no issues. And when we look at this, if you're ignoring the people can help in favor of trying to have some kind of influence with Bill and Hillary Clinton, who were called in to help her out, you know, that she paid for, you know, and then you have Harry Reid and Barack Obama easily running your campaign for you. If the election was a referendum against Obama and against Harry Reid and the liberal left today, then it's clearly obvious that the Grimes campaign was the same thing, especially with the political ties she's had. Agree? Disagree? I mean, the only thing I can see that she ran on, and Alice in Wonderland Grimes ran on two things. I'm a woman, and I'm not Mitch McConnell. That's it. There was nothing else for her to run on because it was all about going into the dirt. And I've got to say this, and then I'm going to get a couple final comments from each of you guys, but I've got to say this, too, because one of the biggest things that I thought right out of the gate when it came to this election, Mitch McConnell went into the dirt immediately. That's a McConnell campaign tactic. We have seen this for too many elections. We know how Mitch McConnell is going to campaign. He's going to go to the dirt. He's going to stick to the game plan beginning to end. He's never going to deviate from it, and he didn't in this campaign either. But miraculously, Alison Grimes, who had no idea how to run a campaign, was just supposed to be a woman that was going to get elected based on the fact she wore a skirt, not on any meaningful dialogue or any meaningful thoughts of her own, went straight to the dirt with him. She didn't even use outside announcers or narrators for her campaign commercials. She decided to go to the dirt. I don't think that reflected very well, if you will, and it sounds sexist, but I don't think that reflected very well for a female candidate against somebody like Mitch McConnell. She didn't take the high road. Final thoughts, Ken? Put them out there, brother. Go ahead.
I'm going to disagree with you on that. I actually think that was smart. I think that was the main mistake Bevin made in his campaign, is he said, I'm not going to go negative. It's like, dude, you know that McConnell's coming with a baseball bat. You better go get a bat. Because he's coming, and he's bringing a bat. And, you know, I think that's the big mistake that Bevin made in the primary. And I actually think that may be the only good thing that Grimes did in her campaign, is that she didn't pull punches, at least at the beginning. And she was actually running a pretty good thing at the very beginning about how Democrats and Republicans have messed up, and we're a new team, and we're here to clean things up, and we're going to fix things. I thought that was powerful. And then somewhere we got lost, and we ended up in the war on women and vote for me because I have a vagina bill. And I got lost, and I think that's what killed her.
That's a good point. Paul Hossie.
I think her the best way that she could have won this race is she would have run it basically the way most people feel, which is, it is the fault of the Democrats and Republicans, and I'm running not to represent one party or the other. I'm running to represent the people of Kentucky. And she also, I think, as both of you've pointed out, you know, when Mitch McConnell's involved in a race, he is bringing a baseball bat. He's bringing a crowbar. And they weren't prepared. It was like I said a little bit earlier. You know, the cardinal rule in politics is you never, ever let your opponent define you. And McConnell did that from the beginning. And yet she failed completely to establish an image, a brand, if you will, a brand. And every campaign has to have its brand. She failed to establish that. She failed to come across as the individual who's going to approach this on behalf of the people of Kentucky. It was always, you know, basically that she was there as a Democrat. And
I
think that's one of the problems that hurt. I think that's what hurt her.
Paul Holliger. Paul Holliger. Okay.
I, for one, I think for everybody on this call and everyone who's listening, I, for one, am so damn glad that this campaign is over. Over! Thank God. But speaking to the Alice in Wonderland Grimes disaster, it reminds me of the cast of Saturday Night Live, the original cast. They called themselves the Not Ready for Primetime Players. Yeah. Allison proves she is clearly not ready for primetime. Clearly. Okay, but the best part about Allison's campaign is that she was the prototypical Democrat who says whatever she thinks needs to be said in order to get elected. Case in point, during the campaign, she kept claiming that she is nonpartisan. She'll work with both sides. But when it was time to prove that, in her concession speech, she went partisan. You can't trust these Democrats when they say they work with both sides. It is a bold-faced, outright lie. So I'm glad that she outed herself, and I think she has seriously damaged herself for the future.
And with that, I'll go ahead and close. Thank you very much. I want to thank Paul Hossie-Kuhn-Mollman and Paul Holliger for joining us tonight. We brought you three different people from three different walks of life, and we hope we brought you a good discussion. For me, I saw a disturbing thing in Kentucky and in Louisville. For me, I saw the status quo win again. There were no changes on the Metro Council here in Louisville. Across the state, there was one seat gained in the state house. And when you listen to Alice in Wonderland Grimes' concession speech, which was very partisan, saying that the Democrats like Steve Beshear, Paul Patton, and all these others, that the Democrats are the wave of the future that's going to lead Kentucky forward, it completely defies logic and completely defies everything we know from national trends. The national elections last night told us that the American people were tired of the status quo, that we want to change. We want to try to move forward. So they elected new leadership. Unfortunately, here in Kentucky, who ranks at the bottom statistically in every measurable category you can possibly imagine, whether it's economic or anything else, misery. And that, to me, is a problem that we're going to start working on seriously in the very near future. It's one of the reasons that we started this GoFundMe page that you can link on edspringston.com, and it's one of the reasons we have the donate button on louisvillepolitics.com. We're going to start taking the lead here. If the Republicans in this city and this state can't do a better job than what they did in this election, that is very disturbing. When people are so poor and so dependent on government that they can't see a way out, that they're too scared to bite the hand that feeds them, this place will always live in misery, and it's one of the reasons that Kentucky will stay behind. For me, it's a very personal issue. I live here. And to think that we had half the Metro Council races that did not have anybody run against them in the Republican Party, to think that a mayor like Greg Fisher got 68% of the vote, most of that vote was because of straight party ticket voting, is disturbing. He didn't have a legitimate candidate, and his illegitimate candidate got 32%. If it wasn't for straight party voting ticket, Greg Fisher would have had a serious problem against somebody who had no business running. But thank Bob DeVore for putting forth the effort. When we look at Dan Johnson in District 21 Metro Council, the same thing. No Republican was put up to run against Dan Johnson in District 21. Dan Johnson does not get any competition in that district, and quite frankly, it's pathetic excuses not to. Well, he's just too powerful. Well, Dan Johnson has got so much excess baggage, I just couldn't even begin to describe to you in the limited amount of time that's left. And yet Dan Johnson only got 68% against an unknown independent who didn't have any money to spend whatsoever. The backlash is there, but the Republican Party on a local and a state level are not doing their job. They instead, everybody knew that Louisville was going to lose with Mitch McConnell. Louisville actually went for Alice in Wonderland Grimes. She got 10 counties. Jefferson County was one of them. 110 went to Mitch McConnell. But it's always that way. And for this local party to continue interjecting themselves, their money, their resources into a national campaign that we know that we're not going to overcome, instead of putting up legitimate contenders on a local level to start winning these local elections, Kentucky will continue to fall behind. That's it for tonight, folks. We hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks so much, Paul Hossie, Paul Holliger, and our good friend Ken Molman. I'll see you tomorrow night at 7 right here. Take care.